Let's say you have a skateboarder coming in and you learn a little bit about skateboarders and you understand they wear their heart on their sleeve. They're going to go jump down a massive staircase over and over and over again for hours until they land that trick. Well, if I have a skateboarder come in and I say, we're going to run 50 sprints today, they'd be out the door. You know, they wouldn't come back, right? But if I say, okay, there's this hula hoop and we're going to spin it backwards and you're going to run down and try to jump through it without knocking it over. Let's see how many times you can get through it. They're going to run sprints all day. They'll run 100 sprints, not the 50 that I wanted, you know? So yeah. Tapping in and understanding yeah. who people are and what the culture of the sport is, I think is very important.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
They peed on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Howdy. Welcome back to the show. This episode is brought to you by SRAM. I want to thank SRAM for being a longtime supporter of the show and also for presenting me and many others with incredibly enjoyable bike experiences on a very regular basis. Just the other day, I was on my mountain bike and I was very tired because that morning, I'd done some really hard intervals on my road bike, but that afternoon, I had a fun, easy endurance mountain bike ride to do. When we have double days like that, and just an easy endurance mountain bike day in the evening, it's pretty free form, and when I'm in a new place or newer place, which I am right now, the Marin Headlands, I take the opportunity to do a little bit of exploring. So I was doing that, and I dropped into a very dark, very rooty trail. And just right off the bat, started going pretty fast and just sending it into sections I'd never seen. The sun had just set, deep forest, and I kind of thought about how much confidence having a dropper post inspires these days. And as I was tiptoeing at speed through these dark, challenging forest trails, it kind of occurred to me, and I try to put myself in past Payson's shoes, imagining doing that with a high post bike, and I just could not even imagine. So I want to thank RockShox and the RockShox Axis dropper post for kind of opening new doors and just making it a hell of a lot more fun to ride my mountain bike, no matter if it's during a race and I'm trying to hold the wheel in front of me going full noise on a race course, or if it's just an evening exploratory cruise in a new place. I highly, highly recommend y'all get your hands on a dropper post if you enjoy mountain biking. It is an absolute game changer, and it's very hard to beat the simplicity of the RockShox Axis. I mean, having a wireless electric dropper post, I mean, it's like we're living in the future, y'all. It's a glorious time to be riding bikes, technologically speaking. Today on the show, Tyler Jewell. Tyler is someone I've wanted to have on the show almost as long as we've had the show. And he's someone that's actually been requested quite a bit. Tyler is the strength and conditioning coach at the Red Bull High Performance Center. The very first training session I ever did with Tyler, I was so impressed. I was just absolutely mind blown by the ingenuity, the way he thinks about structuring training plans, the way he is able to problem solve on the fly, which is something he takes pride in. He's got some maybe non-traditional ways of looking at training that I really appreciate, and his work speaks for itself, and it becomes very clear why he has the job that he does. I hope y'all enjoy this conversation with someone that completely changed the way I think about strength and conditioning training. Tyler, we are here at Red Bull headquarters. One of the only times we've hung out not in the High Performance Center, I feel like. Well, that's not true. We've spent plenty of time outside the offices doing various fun activities outside. But thanks for taking the time. I know you're busy with your typical caring for the athletes in the High Performance Center. I guess just a fun starting point would be, what is your, other than this inconvenience, what does your day look like today?
Hey, let me start with, it's an honor, man. It's it's so cool. I've listened to your podcast. When you asked me, I thought, really? Is there someone standing behind me? But I think that's sort of the role that I like being in, is sort of in the shadows almost, or behind. I think the chapter before this chapter in my life was really all about myself. And it's really neat to be able to give back what was given to me by being a part of what I'm a part of here, and giving at a much greater scale than I was ever able to receive on my end. So I'm super proud of that. And it brings, I think, a lot of balance to that life I had before as trying to be a professional athlete and competing at Olympic level. It's an honor to be on this podcast. It's an honor to be doing what I'm doing, really have my dream job in place. You know,
I was thinking about kind of getting into the, you know, your career and Olympic stuff later, but since you already mentioned it, might as well set that groundwork. So you were an Olymp. You went to the 2000 Olympics. Is that right?
2006 and 2010 Olympics.
You went to two.
Yeah, buddy.
Dude, I'm so out of touch.
It's better that way. Actually, it's like, yeah.
Let the people know, where'd you go? What was it for? How'd you get there?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to represent our country here, good old USA, in 2006 Olympics in Torino, Italy, which I have some bloodlines from Italy. You know, my mother's maiden name is Di Natale, so my family was so proud to go over there. And then, of course, yeah, I got to compete again in 2010. It was an alpine snowboarder, parallel giant slalom was a discipline. And it was sort of a wacky progression for me, where I went to college and played lacrosse and didn't snowboard at all. And then when I graduated college, I thought, man, I would love to give a go at this. I was a weekend warrior and I did pretty good. I was sponsored by a local shop, and because snowboarding was so young, I was able to take the ski racing I did as a kid. Well, yeah, I could ski I was on skis since I could probably walk. And then around 9 or 10, I started snowboarding. Broke my dad's heart. He wanted ski racers, but we were called knuckle draggers back then, and we had to be certified to get onto the mountain. But anyways, it progressed to me doing well at nationals. I got third there, which qualified me for junior worlds, and did pretty good over there, but I never really gave it my all. I never had a coach, was sort of just running around. The skiers would let me train with them. So I thought when I graduated college, man, I got to go for this. I have no idea what's going to happen, but I remember getting laughed at by my roommate's mother. Like, I told her I wanted to play center field for the Red Sox. You know, I went to Boston College. And it was just like, well, I'm going for it. I don't know what was in me that allowed me to go for that. I think the support of my mother really kind of pushed me there. But I thought, I went for it, called some old friends, got some opportunities, some doors opened. I was able to make the U.S. snowboard team within a year due to my good friend Mark Fawcett, who was like a big brother to me. He gave me all his old equipment. He gave me a speed suit, would wax, help me wax my board for the races, and I got to train with this really high-level team. So I knew I had the ability. I just probably needed the opportunity, and Mark gave me that opportunity. And it just sort of transpired from there. There was a lot in between, but you know, it was sort of funny. I decided to camp the summer before 2006 Olympics so I could work out. Because if I took some blue-collar job painting homes, I would just be making enough to pay rent and feed myself that I would never get to train. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to pitch a tent. I lived in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Holy shit.
It was actually, my USADA form was so funny. Like, I'm up the valley on the ridge off Route 44.
No way.
Because that was just when they started installing the rule where you need to tell them where you are.
Whereabouts,
you need to give
them
like an hour of every day. And they never came to the tent, but they got me in the gym a couple of times. But that was one of the coolest experiences of my life. You know, it was like living in the nature channel. You know, there was hawks flying around. A local fox would come by sometimes. And I loved that. It was one of the cooler times of my life. And then, of course, I got to qualify, or I did qualify for the 2006 Olympics as a pretty heavy underdog.
That's like full Rocky Balboa style. That's
crazy.
So what was your... What did training look like when you were in a tent? Day to day, like all the way up a canyon? I mean, you said Crested Butte?
No, Steamboat. So a coach had, and he says he bought it, but he's renting it from ranchers, which leads to a unique story down the line. But he was going to build his dream home on there, didn't have a home on there, so that you can go kind of camp on my land. Mm. And then there was a second coach, Hans Berger, who's had a massive impact on my life. I think I'm super fortunate that I've had so many great coaches. And then now when I'm working with athletes, they think, oh, that's how that coach handled me, because I was probably the biggest pain in the ass as an athlete there was. So I've learned how a lot of different coaches have tried to help me, and it really translates right back to athletes I'm working with. And
is that because you were always asking questions, or?
Yep. And probably goes back, like, I learned differently than people. I think I was pegged as a kid, like, oh, you have a learning disability, and I'm dyslexic, you know. And I thought, oh, well, that's like an excuse for people who, you know, are from affluent towns, and it's just someone who's not as bright. And actually, once it was explained to me, like, hey, man, you just learned differently, and here's your IQ scores, you're very smart. That bit of information, I think I had to do like clearinghouse or something because I wanted to play D1 lacrosse, and I had untimed tests, and there's all these things that had to happen. And so then I had to retest, and then the guy showed me, here's your IQ test. You're superior here, and where you're not as sharp, you're still like the norm, but you just perceive information differently, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I think a lot of coaches had a hard time with me. I'm not an auditory learner at all. Like, I need to see things. It needs to be visual, or I'm a kinesthetic learner, probably why I gravitated towards sports more. But I tell you, confidence is a huge thing. And I went from like C's and D's, you know, to A's and B's as soon as that guy pointed out to me, this is who you are. Whether it was true or not, who knows the validity of that IQ test, but I mean, we see that a lot with athletes too. You know, it's how valid are the things that we're pointing out, but you can see, especially when working with the best athletes in the world, sometimes the dial is just off by a hair, you know, and their confidence is a little skewed. And if you can help that confidence get back, those athletes have spent their whole life building that skill set. Like, I don't like the word talent. I understand the word talent, but I think the definition most people have for talent is wrong. Like, it sounds like that's a given gift, but I believe talent is the product of hard work or a labor of love. Like, you love cycling, so you've cycled your whole life, and that's why you're good at it. It's not like, oh, you were born and you were just never biked and you got on a bike one day and you're good. I don't buy that, you know?
The talent is the mindset more, maybe.
Could be. Yeah, it's really? Still, that sounds like that's given to me.
Okay. Yeah,
I think enough. It's earned. Yeah. And I think there's people who've earned it and maybe don't know it. You know, like, they've loved surfing, and they've just gone to the water every day after school and built a skill set that now feels like it's given because they just loved it. But they broke their ass off to get good at that sport, you know? And I feel like it takes away a little bit when someone says, oh, this person's so talented. Mm-hmm. I don't buy it.
Yeah. Interesting. So going back to your Olympic path there, you said in 06 you were a pretty big underdog. Was that the year that Sean Palmer had his super high profile injury? And
he
like
snapped his Achilles, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that was, I think that was Bardonecchia where we were in, I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a, because I remember seeing that documentary and I remember him being like heavy favorite. And then he had that injury and I thought of you. I was like, Tyler was there during all that.
Yeah.
Like, that was going, like, you were probably teammates theoretically.
We were. Yeah, it was super interesting. I don't know, was that 2006? Had to been, you know. You were sort of all funneled together. I can remember 2006, we would all go, and Olympics is amazing, right? You get this huge shopping cart, they fill it full of clothes, and here's opening ceremonies, here's closing ceremonies, here if you're on the podium, this is what you're going to wear Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, you know, it's like, oh my God, and you're getting like bags and bags of clothes, which the funnest part is giving that to all your family members after, and everyone's super stoked on that. But you're also then processing with all the snowboarders, which would have been Sean White, I think Danny Cass was another one. Who was it? Elena Height. Well, I haven't thought about this a lot, but anyways, you're all there and you're started getting to know each other, and there's a mutual respect. And that is so fun to be around those athletes immediately in your craft. But then also, I can remember being in the gym and like seeing the bobsledders just hand cleaning heavy weight. And then next to him is a guy in a sarong. And I'm like, oh, what's this dude, Johnny Weir? And he's doing, jumping up and doing two twists and landing on one foot and sticking it like this is a bunch of freak shows here and I love it, man. What am I doing here? Yeah. How the hell did I sneak in here? But, you know, it's just what an amazing pleasure and honor to be around so many athletes, you know. But I would say that it's also a bit guarded where Alpine snowboarding was the last event, parallel giant slalom. So we were very fortunate. We weren't worried about being distracted. And we went into opening ceremonies and then we left in what they called a safe house. And I could put a lot of knocks on USSA, but I could also say that at the Olympics, they really roll out the red carpet and treat the athletes like gold. You know, there's a chef there to cook whatever you wanted, you know, and it really took care of you. And so we were in the Olympic Village, and then we had the opportunity to go out to this safe house kind of zone and really let us prepare. And I can remember actually in Italy also, we had the whole trail closed to ourselves. And there was like, it was that year I was the only guy who got to qualify because they added in a new discipline but didn't give us more quota spots. So there was a real death fight almost over the spots. And so the two girls who were on the team decided not to train that day. So it was me. And this, I got the hill to myself, perfect snow. And I remember turning to my coach like, you got to send some of these people home. Like, this is making me nervous. There's 10 staff breathing down my neck. Like, and this
is the only one.
I was the only one. Like, I was more the guy who wanted to race like I trained, meaning I didn't want to acknowledge that this was the Olympics. You know, if I acknowledged this is the Olympics, I probably would have peed down my leg and fallen over in the Starcade, you know? Like, I had to distract myself, like, this is just another race, another day. I was very lucky, like I said, that I could open up and say it's opening ceremonies and try to harness some of that energy. But if I completely allowed myself to connect with that, I would have froze, I think, you know?
Interesting. So you mentioned that one thing you really appreciate about your job now is the ability to support athletes, maybe in a way that you felt like as an athlete yourself, there were some shortcomings. Like the support network you had maybe wasn't quite as good as it could have been. Having that experience, how does that inform, you know, your job now? What are some things that you think about now, having been an athlete? You think, oh yeah, here's something that Johnny Collinson or Angel or Brooke McDonald or whoever's in the gym on a given day, you know, this is something that I can offer them that I remember would have been, you know, really, really appreciated when I was an athlete. Does anything come to mind in that regard?
I think you hit the nail on the head. And I got what I needed as an athlete, but then when you start seeing when there's more opportunity in an entrepreneur environment where you could come to the table and say, hey, I've got this idea and you can push it through, and then there can be funds to back that up. There wasn't as much funds, but there was the key ingredient I had from coaches that they were 100% in. And that's what I believe is the key ingredient that I want to give. And that coupled then with support can be deadly great, you know? But yeah, it's, I think everything happens for a reason. I'm not like at all ever looking at it like I wish I had that, but it probably drives me because I was always more aware of where things could have gone. And then I can actually take it there. And that's what I'm really pointing at. Like, man, I'm so grateful for my experience. And I think sometimes they say that some of the better coaches are the ones that never really got there or never really that great. And I fit in that category of, you know.
I don't know about that, dude. You went to two Olympics.
I didn't medal, you know. I didn't medal.
All right. This is serious standards. Yeah. It is funny you say that, though. I've heard that over and over. And you look at someone like, I don't know, in basketball, like Greg Popovich, or never played in the NBA. One of the best basketball coaches of all time, Bill Belichick. You know, you don't hear about Bill Belichick's incredible NFL career. You hear about his coaching career.
Yeah.
And you hear that in my world in cycling sometimes too, where so they have the directors that are driving around in team cars, and they have a radio connection with the riders, and they can say things like, you know, in 2 kilometers, we have a 90-degree left-hand turn, and there's just going to be ripping crosswind. Expect it to get really, really hard. Like, get in position now. And a lot of times, the directors that are best at communicating those sorts of things are the ones that were pro riders, but not the best pro riders. And so they can speak to the whole team and be like, you need to start moving up now because you have certain abilities. Whereas if it was, you know, one of the best of all time, they can put off getting in position. They can wait until like 200 meters before that turn and then just scoot up the side, be good to go. Doesn't burn many matches. And so I totally hear what you're saying. Like, a lot of times I think there is something to that idea of really, really good coaches are the ones that had to really figure it out, look at it from a bunch of different angles, maybe fail a whole bunch of times, work with the grain, and just have a massive bank of knowledge, like live in a tent, to get to the Olympics. Like, that's crazy, man. That's so cool.
You're right. It's, I mean, the culmination of everything from all the different coaches and all the different approaches. And then, yeah, you failed. Let me try from this angle. You failed. Let me try from that angle. You know, and you're learning along the way. And I think for some who shoot right to the top, maybe they have less learnings. Could be. Not to say that there wouldn't be great coaches, but hasn't been my path.
Yeah. So how did you end up in the position that you have now? 2010 Olympics, which were in
Vancouver. Yeah.
From Olympic day that day until where we sit today.
Right.
Give us a quick timeline.
Well, I think it's for sure starts with Per Lundstrom, who's the director of the high performance program at Red Bull here. And he was my strength and conditioning coach when I was an athlete. But I was actually an athlete that didn't quite fall under his umbrella. But I went to him and said, I need your help. I see what you're doing. I respect you. I want to train. I want to learn from you. And so I had that kind of connection with him. And he took me on. And he didn't have to. And then by taking me on, he ended up taking on the whole Alpine snowboard team. So that broadened his base. And that, to me, typifies who Per Lundstrom is. I mean, this guy is a beast and one of the best people I've ever met, who's just always giving, always caring. It's incredible to think of how many lives he's affected and how many opportunities he's given people. And so I always stayed in touch with him. I always appreciated him as a coach and always appreciated what he did for me as an athlete. And I can remember him coming and saying, Tyler, I'm leaving and I'm going to go work at Red Bull. And when I was an athlete and we were at the Center of Excellence then, and I just stayed in touch.
So sorry, were you a Red Bull athlete?
Never. No.
Okay.
No.
So how did that connection with Red Bull come about?
Andy Walsh was the director of sports science at USSA, and Per worked together with him. Then Andy came here and started the program, I believe, in 2006. And he was the only guy. And so now the program's grown quite a bit. He had left the program maybe 2 years ago. But so it started with Andy, and I think all hats should go off to him for the program here now. So to backtrack to that, where I'm at, I had finished as an athlete. Not fully finished. That was a hard thing for me. I love my sport. If I could still be doing it today, I would be. I'm glad that I'm not, and I was forced to start the next chapter of my life, and I've really found a special place for myself and happy, because I didn't think anything could ever compare to racing on World Cup and being competitive and hanging out with the Austrian guys and then getting to know the Swiss dudes, and like you're in there on their turf and they're showing you here's where you go to eat and you're going out for the special drink or whatever it is, and you're learning so much. I looking back, sport was a vehicle for me to grow as a person, you know, where I at the time I was really focused on I just wanted to win. But looking what that did for me, it's an amazing education that can't be bought. So going back to finishing, I had been in touch with Per a lot. I had watched a documentary about, it's a funny story actually, where there was a guy who was, he had a music venue, and he really wanted Elvis Presley to play at his music venue. And he kept calling his agent, and the guy wouldn't even talk to him in the beginning. And then he just decided he's going to call this guy once a month. And then they became buddies. And it was like over 6 years. The guy, he's calling Elvis Presley's agent every month or whatever it was. I don't remember the details perfectly. But they became buddies. And finally, after 6-7 years, whatever it was, the guy said, okay, Elvis will finally play at your venue, right? And that's me with Per Lundstrom. I'm calling Per like, dude, what are you doing? This is what I'm trying to do. I'm starting to wrap up as an athlete, but I hadn't really... I went to the wheels fell off as an athlete. I ran out of money. I moved back in with my folks. I studied to take the CSCS, which I studied in college to be a school teacher. So I had no biology. I had no idea, you know, what a sarcomere was, the smallest contractile unit in a muscle, and the Krebs cycle and these things. Like, oh my God. I'm like, I took 6 months. I studied it. I nailed my test. And then I had an internship at the USOC through a friend of mine who was a trainer down in Chula Vista, Amanda Whitmire. I think she's married and changed her name now, but she was the best. She was so sweet to me. Like, of course I'm going to take you as an intern. I think you're above this level. And I said, no, I'm not. It was my quest as an athlete was I feel like I knew what to do, but I never cared to know the why because I didn't have time for that. Those were PhDs. Those were the scientists. I would test them in my own way to know that they knew what they knew, and then I'd be good with it. I didn't need to know it. But I did. I remember I bought my own Lactate Pro, and I ran my own lactates on the road. I was super interested in that. Like, I wanted to know that I was nailing my sessions, and there's a lot for that to, you know, that you can gain a lot of confidence from that, knowing that, hey, I've left no stone unturned. Mm-hmm. I'm standing in the start gate now. Pressure's off. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I keep digressing. Excuse me.
No. I mean, all of that is fascinating.
Yeah. So with Pear, I just stayed in touch. I finished my internship where I was living in the barracks in Colorado Springs with college kids.
At the USOC.
The USOC. I'm 36 years old. And there's like 19, 20, probably over 21 college kids because they're coming home drunk every night and keeping me up. And I was like the old curmudgeon there, like, go to sleep. I got to work. And I just wanted to be there. I wanted to get my start. I wanted to get this going. And after my 6 months of $100 a month or whatever I was making and eating the cafeteria food, but I loved it. My existence as an athlete was a very simple one, and I didn't need much, nor do I need very much now. I've tried to break that pattern to like, I can go out to eat. Like, it used to be like, well, I could go out to eat and spend this amount of money, or I can go home and eat an 89 cent, you know, 1/10 of an 89 cent Rima pasta. I can have a 10 cent meal versus a 10, 20, 50 here in LA meal. That's crazy, you know? So I've tried to shift that mindset to be more of a normal person and stop that existence, you know? And now I've got some women in my life because of, or a woman in my life. I'm going to be in trouble. But, you know, gaining relationships where it was like, why can't I have a relationship? Like, dude, you've lived out of your car and you're eating pasta every night with butter on it. You know, like, you got to change some things. But
love it.
So I finished that internship and I went back home, and my buddy Victor, who's had the biggest impact on me outside of family, this was probably, I was a senior year in high school, I broke my hand playing football, and my mom got me visits with Victor, who is a personal trainer. And like I said, this had been 93, 94, something like that, and he changed my life. Like, I went from skinny, insecure kid to I've got, you know, put on, I think, 10 pounds. I went from 155 to 165. When I got out of my cast, I had this little baby arm for breaking my hand playing football. And then Victor got me back to, holy shit, like, I'm a man now. Mm. And I went from like medium level lacrosse player that year, senior year, to MVP of the team. Wow. Won 80% of the faceoffs I took, was one of the leading scorers. We were Eastern Conference champs. Like, it was, okay, I've arrived. It was a little bit late for lacrosse because you're recruited your junior year. But that got me into Boston College there. But anyways, Victor taught me a lot. Victor was a bodybuilder, but looking back, the training I did probably wasn't ideal, but it was ideal for me because it gave me so much confidence. And I think confidence is a huge piece. And I think that is a thread still that I definitely respect in training, even high level athletes. Okay, if you tell me you want super huge biceps, it's like I don't think that's going to help you on the bike and try to educate against it. But if you're dead set on it, let's get you some big biceps, man, because I think the trade-off can be more there if your confidence is there versus the actual the physiology, or blending that at least, you know.
For the record, I have not requested that of you. Have Tyler. Not.
No, yet. There was another athlete who was a cyclist who did, but it was BMX.
That's funny. He just wanted some aesthetic muscle.
I think, yeah.
Interesting.
Which, I mean, look.
Whatever.
In college, I knew this football player who was a gnarly guy, muscles practically on the top of his head. Like, and I'm sitting next to him in class. We had some same classes, and I got to know him. And I look over, and his fingernails were glossy. I was like, dude, you painting your fingernails? And he looked me square in the eye and said, you got to look pretty to play pretty, dog. And it was like, holy shit, there's something to that, right? Yeah. There's confidence there. And it was like, okay, you paint your finger. I didn't go get my fingernails glossed, but I lifted some weights in some ways that probably wasn't appropriate for me. And at one point I overdid it. I put on 25 pounds one summer, and I was an elephant on the lacrosse field and had my worst season ever. And then I realized, okay, there you can overdo it. More is not always better. I always joke with everyone, like, come on, every athlete's know more is better. But in this case, it's not. But I do respect that as something that can be done for some folks, and it can help build confidence. That was a huge influence on me. So I went back home, and Victor gave me a lot of business, and I started my own personal training business. And within 1 week, I had 20 hours worth of clients. And after that week,
post snowboard career.
Yeah. I still haven't retired though, so it's not over.
Oh, really? you haven't had your retirement tour?
I couldn't bring myself to retire. No, but it's over.
Yeah.
But Victor started me in, and I had my own business. It was going great. And lo and behold, I got a phone call from Pear and said, hey, well, we could use a hand out here. I thought, oh man, I just started my own business.
So how did Pear end up? So Pear was at Red Bull?
No, yeah, Pear was at Red Bull.
How did he end up at Red Bull?
Andy Walsh brought just him recruited. Over from the ski team. Yeah, right? Okay. And that was around must have been 2010.
Yeah.
And I had stayed in touch with him since then. I already stayed in touch with him, obviously, all throughout the year. And I would send back updates like, hey, I got this. And I would like take the little extra scratch I had and buy him a bottle of whiskey or whatever I thought was appropriate, and always showing that I was really appreciative, which I was and still am to this day, because of people like Victor, because of people like Pear, because of all the coaches that I mentioned, Hans earlier, all these great coaches. They allowed me to realize my dreams in a lot of ways, and what a cool thing to be able to try to give that back to others.
Yeah.
Pear called me and said, hey, man, you want to come out? We got a position for 6 months. And this is after I had been berating him for the last 3 years or two or however long it was. And like, dude, I just want to learn from you. And a lot of people would think, oh, you're going out there to work with the best athletes in the world. But I came out here with nothing to work next to Pear. I wanted to learn from him. For me, it's awesome working with high-level athletes, but I'd be just as happy working with high school kids or anybody. I just want to help people reach their fullest potential, help people reach their goals. I think there's nothing cooler in life than to set a really great goal and go for it. Then it, win, lose, or draw, it doesn't matter, but you went for it. Yeah. And if I can play a role in helping someone reach that goal, sign me up. I want to be a part of that the rest of my life, you know? And by being here, man, it's like there's so much opportunity and so much to give, and you see it so fast with such high level athletes. It's an incredible process. And now I'm realizing how lucky I am, because I'm learning so much back. I mean, we interface here every day with athletes who are best in the world at what they do. Mm-hmm. And it is not us coming above or me coming above and pointing my finger down. This is how you need to do it. It's, hey, you're above. You're already really good at what you do. How can I help? And in that process, you learn a lot. And then you can transfer that from one athlete to the next as well. I mean, you start building that up. That's experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, Pear said, hey, we got a 6 month position for you. Come on out. And I consume information through documentaries or podcasts or other ways. I'm not a big reader, but I was watching a different documentary, and it was like Warren Buffett or one of those fancy guys who's made a ton of money, and his first job was in New York City, and he didn't know what he was getting paid until he got his first paycheck. And I told that story to Pear, and I said, I would love to do that, because this is my dream job. I want to come out and work with you and be a part of what's going on out there. But I can't. I've got $500 in my bank account or whatever it is. I can't hardly afford a plane ticket. I need to know what I'll be making so I can pay my bills. And with the kind of the ability I had as a snowboard athlete and how frugal I was, I kind of crunched the numbers, and it's like, yeah, I can do this. And they were actually very sweet and gave me a little kind of chunk up front too, like, this will help you get out here and get your feet on the ground. And always going to be grateful for that and the opportunity that Pear opened the door for me here. And so 6 months turned into a year turned into two, and suddenly it's 6.5 years later. I came out in August 2013.
So why, if it was a 6 month position at first, like, how did that change? Just because you became
indispensable? I was just like, I'm like pit bull on that. Like, I'm here. Like, my biggest asset is I can work hard.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here on the weekends. I'm painting the lines on the track. I'm doing whatever needs to be done, organizing the cage. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of athletes coming in, you know, but I wasn't going to just sit on my hands. I was going to find stuff to do. And,
you came out here knowing it was a 6 month opportunity, but already thinking in your head, like, I'm going to prove myself and I'm going to make myself indispensable. and or was that
not
really
the case? It's weird how sometimes I operate. I don't let myself go there. I just thought like I really believed it was 6 months.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm gonna just go hard 6 months.
Yeah.
And it kind of caught me 4 years later because it's like I kept going hard. And I thought it was a 6 month sprint that turned into a year sprint, that turned into a 2 year sprint, that turned into, oh my God, like I'm living in a 350 square foot apartment. There's jail cells bigger than this. I don't have a picture on the wall. I've worn a hole in the ground from work to my place and back and forth. And you know, I'm still eating the 10-cent meal pasta. Is like, hang on a sec, dude. Like, you've got to try to figure out a life for yourself too, you know? And so that was a cool piece for me too, then, to start figuring out and doing what they call adulting. And I got a little bit more responsible place and put some pictures on the walls and kind of put myself in check a little bit too. And yeah, it was a brilliant thing to finally understand that this wasn't a sprint and I'm here, and changed a lot for me to say, okay, I'm going to have an apartment and live like a normal person and try to break some of those old patterns that were allowing me to be very successful as an athlete, but then were sort of holding me back to develop as a adult beyond sport, you know?
Yeah. So we've talked some about why, you know, you appreciate Pear so much personally. And I absolutely echo that. What are some of the things that he's done in the past or is doing now that you really appreciate just from a trainer standpoint? Things that really inspire you, things that made you realize, I want to be around this guy. I want to learn as much as I can
from
what he's doing and how he operates.
There's not a lot of people in my life where you meet them and something happens. You're like, man, I would have never thought of that. I would have never taken that perspective on that. And that's Pear. He comes up with some training ideas that are like, holy shit, that is exactly perfectly right. How did you get there?
Yeah.
And I still haven't been able to crack the code 6 years later. I'm like, Pear, how do you? And he's such an artist with it. It's incredible. And it fits. And he has some ability that I don't know how or what. I mean, he goes into a room somewhere and comes out with an amazing program for an athlete. It's like, well, where did that come from, man? And it's, I don't know that, maybe he doesn't know, you know, but I think he absorbs a lot about a person on some sort of level and his experience. And I mean, he's told me he was a ski racer and then he injured his knee and then, yeah, he started writing the programming for everybody. And then suddenly he was more of a coach. He really wanted to be a ski racer, but he ended up being an S&C coach more than anything. I think, you know, one of my favorite stories of Pear, there's a guy named Jan who was my snowboard coach, and Jan grew up with Pear in Sweden and they ski raced together. And Pear would travel with a barbell, a 45-pound barbell or 20 kilo, you know, and
full
with
Olympic
weights,
width.
Olympic width, weights, and maybe even a rack, and you'd lift in the hotel room the event.
What?
I love that shit.
How do you travel with that?
I mean, yeah, he did it.
Holy shit.
Like,
just, it doesn't surprise me at
incredible.
All.
Like, well, and that's where it comes in down to that 100% all in and that passion. And I think if you have that, you can't really go wrong. If you're all in and really wanting to give, then, you know, yeah, you might go wrong, but you're going to learn from that. And to me, that was the most important thing as an athlete. If someone were all in, let's go. I'm all in. You're all in. And sometimes I'd feel bad. Like, why are you all in? I know why I'm all in because I'm trying to go to the Olympics and win a medal. But what do you get out of it? And I didn't understand that as an athlete. And now I understand it a bit more. Like, well, just want to give back what was given to me. You know, I don't think most of the people around, I don't think anyone's like trying to live through or any way or recreate. I don't think that's it. For most coaches, they are at a good level. I think it's just the desire to want to be able to give and help and maybe play a small role in someone else's journey. Because so many, at least in my case, I can't speak for anyone else, but so many people gave for me to get to where I got. And so I would love to be able to do that for other people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that process of progress is just so, so rewarding and so addictive. I mean, as you know, as an athlete, and then, I think one thing that is really cool about this Red Bull family we have is I feel that towards the other athletes too. Like when we're in HP, they're working on different things and you start to see something out of the corner of your eye, someone that's really pushing themselves, maybe doing a challenging move. Sometimes, you know, you'll kind of stop and just watch their process, and it's so gratifying. Whether it's, you know, a Johnny Collinson doing some crazy gymnastics strength move, and, you know, the first 10 minutes he's not close to doing it, and then 20, 30 minutes later he's nailing it.
Right.
Like, that makes me so happy as an athlete. So I can't even imagine how being in your shoes feels when you're the one that's walking him through that, trying to help break it down, trying to deliver him to that point. It is such a special thing to be a part of. I absolutely feel that too.
Yeah, I'm honored to play a small role in that. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the athletes who've got to pull out of the start gate and cross the finish line, or the athletes who've got to jump out of the airplane, or whatever it is. But I think a lot of folks recognize that they want a team to be able to help support that. And I always felt as an athlete, I was standing on the shoulders of my wax tech, my coach, the physical therapist, and all those people were helping me get there. And there's no way I could have done it on my own. But at the end of the day, I had to pull out of the start gate and I had to cross the finish line. And it is you've got to do it.
Yeah. A couple quick pair of stories that come to mind. Literally just a few days ago, I was in the High Performance Center pretty late, finishing up a little strength workout, and then was in the Normatex, you know, getting recovered, and it was, I don't know, 7:15. I was like, yeah, you know, you're putting in the time, like, go pacing. And then I see Pear walk in, and I'm like, man, Pear's still at the office. Wow. And he racks up the bench press there. I'm like, oh, okay, Pear's going to work out. And he just starts loading weight on and, you know, does a few reps and starts loading more weight on. I'm like, pretty soon I'm like, wow, that is what I was deadlifting earlier. And then he puts more weight on. I'm like, that is more than I was deadlifting. And he's just doing reps, just rep after rep after rep at this huge weight, you know, late at night. And I know he was in the office before everybody else too. And I'm just like, man, this is really cool. That's all these years later too.
Yeah.
And he just is doing it. Like, he doesn't have any huge event that he's preparing for, but he's grinding just like you do too, grinding right there with the athletes. I mean, both of you guys are so fit still. That's one thing that really, really sold me. Not that I had any hesitation whatsoever, but just got me extra excited is when I first came in here and started learning from y'all. The fact that you can do everything you ask of us, like physically,
right,
is amazing. There are not many coaching situations where that's the case, I don't think.
Oh, respect. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's super important. If I'm going to ask someone to do something, I better be able to do it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, or at least attempt it and be willing to fail. And then, of course, yeah, you might work with some athletes who shoot way past what you can do, like you mentioned Johnny doing those handstands and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's neat to have some physical challenges in with the training as well, so you can track progress in more than one way instead of just let's put more weight on the bar, especially if those challenges are physical challenges or new awareness of your body are adding to what we like to call like a situational bank pair, and I've talked about a lot. Or yeah, maybe it's a something that you may never get, but the progression of trying to get there is a very healthy progression of flexibility, some sort of core strength or some other different body understanding that might not look like it relates to your sport, and maybe it doesn't, but I think it's going to allow a better athlete in the long run, a more well-rounded athlete in my eyes. You know?
Yeah. One other quick story that comes to mind about Pear is, somewhere early on, y'all gave me this 10-page printout of a strength progression, just general full body strength.
Right.
And it had, you know, some little descriptions and then these little grainy photos of someone demonstrating the moves. And I was pretty new still and just flipping through and tried a few things and get to the 10th page just out of curiosity, because I knew the 10th page was going to be super gnarly.
Yeah.
And there's someone just doing a flag off the side of a squat rack.
Yeah.
I was like, a flag. Holy shit. Don't know if that's a thing I'm going to be working towards. And I look a little closer. I'm like, I'll be damned if that's Pear.
It's Pear.
He's the dude demonstrating every move. And I was like, what the fuck, man?
No, he is a maniac.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And yeah.
For those that don't know, a flag, I mean, how would you describe it? You're basically holding yourself. You have your hands holding the vertical part of a squat rack. And your body is...
it's like a flag blown in the wind. You're horizontal to the floor.
Horizontal to the floor.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even hardly make sense from a physics standpoint. Like, the sheer strength.
Well, and you'd... Hard. Pear is...
Can you do one of those?
I cannot. No, I cannot. Pear is, 220, something like that, 6'2", thick dude, and you'd think he's just a dude bench pressing, but if you ever seen him in a pair of shorts, his legs are tree trunks. You know, yeah. It's not like, that's not the case. He's an all-around freak show, and he says he's naturally an endurance athlete, which is very interesting. Sort of a sheep in wolf's clothing, or I don't know if that's the right way to say that, yeah, but yeah, I think he can run like the wind as well, so he's definitely it. He worked a lot to build himself up to that point, to be able to walk in. I've seen him walk out of meetings in jeans and a button down and get in the Agaton and put every weight in the gym on there and push it. You're going to warm up. Yeah, I did that in 1990.
That's amazing.
Did that in 1990. So in some cases, do as someone says, do. But
That's exactly what happened the other night. Is he just like sat down on the bench press deal, started loading weight.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd just gotten off his computer shooting off emails.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Absolutely.
All right. So we'll start wrapping up here soon because you've got athletes to help. But I'd like to break down a little bit of your daily process because that's one thing that I think really sets you apart. And I've certainly been the beneficiary of that plenty of times already. But you work with such a diverse group of athletes. Of course, no two athletes are ever the same, but the number of sports that you have to help someone prepare for is really, really crazy. Like, you're in such a unique position. You have cyclists, surfers, skateboarders, you know, full gamut. Your ability to listen to the athlete's thoughts, have background on their needs, and then craft some specific work to them is mind-blowing. I'm wondering if you could kind of break down that process a little bit for us. Cause you love to say like, you know, I made this up on the spot, and you and I know that that's a good thing.
Right.
But I think culturally, a lot of times that's maybe seen as a negative thing.
Right.
But maybe you can explain why that's maybe not quite the case.
Well, for starters, I'm part of an epic team of world-class people. So I have the good fortune to go to Dan Turner and say, hey, I got a cyclist in, and I don't know a lot about that world. Can you help me?
Yeah, Dan being the lead physiologist, basically. He's like the mad scientist of this
Dan
whole team.
Dan is brilliant. Doogie Howser, MD, to the max, right? Like, maybe he's gotten a little bit older than Doogie Howser, but Dan is the best and super bright, and I will go to him, or I can go to Kristen Bell, our dietitian, or reach out to anyone within our team and pick their brain and then come back. And I'm a culmination of that. You know, I'm not, and then, like I said, all the experiences that I've had has helped me make those decisions in the moment. But I think what you're referring to is something where I'm probably different than most. And I had my sister-in-law's sister one time told me, Tyler, don't bother thinking like everyone else because they're already doing it. Think your own way. And so this could upset some folks, but I remember getting called out once, like, did you make those movements up on the spot for that athlete? I said, sure did. You know, it's I think it's better to try to construct something at least early on in the exploration phase, which unfortunately is a lot here because athletes will come through and then they're gone and you don't get a long period of time with athletes. So that sort of does limit things. And so I've developed in a way such that this environment has wanted me to develop. It's not the ideal situation, of course not, but I do think it's very important in that exploratory phase to be able to interview the athlete, to be able to ask questions, be able to understand where they're at, and then give them what they need where they're at, not saying I'm going to jam you a circular peg into a square hole because that's what I thought of 2 weeks ago, or it's all made up anyways. I made it up at 1 o'clock in the morning by myself. How does that make sense?
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense that I'm looking that person in the eyeballs and I can feel how they're feeling. I can feel what they're into when I start to suggest something and you see their eyes glaze over or their like body language is telling you something else. One of the coolest things I learned from one of my coaches, Jerry Masterpool, who is a rancher, who's hands down actually probably the best coach I've ever worked with. And I learned so much from him. He would make you believe anything. It was incredible how he would approach people. And he told me, Tyler, if you ever wanted to coach with me, I would have you out on his ranch. He was a rancher part-time, and I'd have you learn how to work with animals and work with a horse in particular. I never got to work with a horse, but I took what he said to heart, and I trained. My mom had a puppy when I was home studying for that CSCS before I did my internship in Colorado Springs, and I trained the puppy through all sorts of things and trained her to first, I wanted to get her on my back and hang, but I saw she was motivated by a Frisbee. So I got her to jump on a chair. And then I got her first as a little box, then a chair, then a box on a chair. Went through this whole progression. And finally she would jump on my back off the chair or the box on the chair and then go off real quick. And I went through this whole thing and I figured out like, well, if she's not doing what I'd like her to do, it's because I'm not asking her in the right way. And I also may have to wait till she presents to me what I would like her to do. I really wanted to get her to crawl. And she would never, I couldn't communicate to her properly how to crawl until one day she was upstairs in the house where she wasn't supposed to be and she cowered. And then she was crawling. I thought, now's my time. Crawl. I attached the word crawl to it and got her out in the backyard quick. And suddenly I got her to crawl. But she had to present to me when she was ready to crawl. Mm-hmm. I had to wait for that moment. And I think that's a lot with athletes too. How I'm communicating, I know I might want to try to do a certain thing with them, but I need to wait until they're ready for that, until they're presenting that. So I may have the best training program in the world, but it's on rollerblades. And if a skateboarder comes in and they're going to look at me like, dude, I'm not getting in rollerblades, that's not cool, then my whole program's blown. I need to figure out what works for that athlete, and I need to be able to match what that is. And something Paris taught me a lot, and even Andy Walsh said, mate, just have them pick up something heavy and put it back down again. It means start somewhere, apply a stress to create an adaptation. It doesn't, in my mind, matter how we apply that stress. We need to apply a stress to the body or the muscles, more specifically, to create an adaptation. So why not try to find a clever way where the person's engaged, where they're going to want to come back and do it again? Let's say you have a skateboarder coming in and you learn a little bit about skateboarders and you understand they wear their heart on their sleeve. They're going to go jump down a massive staircase over and over and over again for hours until they land that trick. And that's what's gaining respect in that culture is, I finally landed it. Mm-hmm. So how can you use that to its advantage? Well, if I have a skateboarder come in and I say, we're going to run 50 sprints today, they'd be out the door. You know, they wouldn't come back, right? But if I say, okay, there's this hula hoop and we're going to spin it backwards and you're going to run down and try to jump through it without knocking it over. Let's see how many times you can get through it. They're going to run sprints all day. They'll run 100 sprints, not the 50 that I wanted, you know? So yeah. Tapping in and understanding who people are and what the culture of the sport is, I think is very important. And I think that is a nice way to get the work done. And it's quite fun too, to be able to problem solve and do that together. We have media folks come in to the training center here and ask, whoa, what's the coolest piece of equipment? And there's this cryo sauna and you have this. And undoubtedly every time say, see anyone with one of those caps on, you know, the Red Bull cap, they're the ones that are making this place special. And that synergy that you talked about earlier is priceless. Sometimes you just create the environment and step back and let the athletes push each other and inspire each other. That's the true thing that makes our place here special, in my mind. It's not about some fancy EMG shorts or any of that. And you could talk to other people in the team, they'd tell you totally opposite. And I think that's what's special too, is we have a lot of different perspectives to make up a great team. Mm. If we all thought the same way, it's not going to work. I think it's very important. And probably what got me my seat at the table was the fact that I have walked a mile in the athlete's shoes, and I have done the training, and I know what that feels like. And I can do some of the movements, like you said, that kind of was important for you, and that was important for me too. Yeah. I think there's a lot there, but from my side, I think it's very important to spend time to get to know the person first, understand where they're at, and meet them where they're at, instead of, okay, I know your sport, I know your data from the test, I know what your sport needs, and bang, here's this report coming down in front of you, and it might as well be in Japanese, because you're like, what the heck is all this? Yeah. But then there's some athletes who will read through that and go home and do it. And more your world, actually, where you guys are used to looking at that. But like you pointed out, we work with a lot of different athletes. And I don't think it's, oh, this is a program for skateboarders, this is a program for cyclists, this is a program for surfers. I think this is a program for this athlete who happens to be a skateboarder. I think it's person first, sport second.
Interesting.
Of course, there's the needs analysis process. You need to know what's important for that sport. But you may have one skateboarder who's super explosive and another who isn't, but the other who isn't doesn't need to be explosive because he's a more finesse guy and he's more street, or a bowl guy has more eccentric loading and he needs to be a bit stronger. He needs to take a more of a beatdown when he wipes out in the bowl, or what, you know, it's all different. And then even within a lot of these sports, there's different approaches. So it's not, I don't think it's a one size fits all for sport. And I think more importantly, it's like what the first thing I understood it as is, okay, you're working with one of the best athletes in the world. Here's the keys to a really fancy car. Don't scratch it. You know, just, you know, explore, tread lightly, have a small impact. We're not reinventing the wheel. We don't need to do that. You're already really good. But usually athletes are coming when they're banged up and they're looking for something more. They're not coming usually like, hey, I want to come in and I've just won every race there is and I need something more. But that is actually the direction where we're going, where in particularly an athlete came through and was like, whoa, I haven't heard this case before, which was pretty neat, right? And we're growing and we're building here and it's becoming more. But I can remember in the early days getting on my phone and texting like, this athlete, that, oh, you want to come in? Where are you at? Like, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here.
It's either work with you or paint the lines on the track again. You know, want to come in and work out? You know, but and it wasn't as much equipment. It hasn't grown. And now to see where it's at now and a little bit where it's growing and it's, oh, you might not be able to spend as much time and be as prepared. And I think in the direction it's going, we're going to need more support and a bigger space. And yeah, it's like anything, you know. Yeah. It starts with, you know, a guy making donuts in the back of his house and there's cooking with love, and you know, suddenly those go out and then they need more, and then you got to hire more people, and yeah, and it builds up and gets better. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that next progression of what we're doing here, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I love that moment a few days ago when we were working together, and I kind of wanted you to check out my deadlift and my squat form, and we were just working in some deadlift work, and you just had me do a deadlift and just observed, and I looked over at you and, you know, you had a bit of an expression on your face, and I thought, oh man, like, oh, my deadlift's not very good. And I was like, how are we doing? And you're like, that's a great deadlift. I was like, okay, sweet. It's like, but I don't think that's what you should be doing. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And you sort of broke down, you know, what are we actually trying to, as a cyclist, what are you trying to accomplish here? What adaptations are we trying to create? And we sort of broke down, you know, the traditional movement that puts so much strain on your lower back of a traditional deadlift, what that's strengthening versus a deadlift that many people would say is quote unquote not great form, which is very leg reliant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit, like, yeah, I have a great deadlift. A great deadlift is not what I should be doing. And because I'd had some instruction in the past, I go to this gym in Durango when I'm home all the time. And there's great lifters in there that are knowledgeable, and they help me nail down a pretty solid deadlift. But I can't wait to go back in there and do a bad deadlift now because it's the right move for me.
Yeah.
And like, you just picked up on that so fast and then explained it so easily and so quickly. I was like, holy shit. It's just so, just the willingness to think a little bit outside the box and a little bit non-traditionally is so special. Like, I really, really value that as an athlete.
You're going to choke me up, man. You're giving me the chills. That means the world to me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I could be lynched by the whole SNC community. Like, what do you mean? The deadlift is one of the classic movements and everyone should do it. But I think there's a time and place. And I don't think you should even go near wearing out your body in a way such that you can't do your sport. If you're gonna wear something out, or I'm sort of struggling for the right words here, but let's say you have an action sport athlete, why would they ever do something that could possibly, you know, wear them out in the gym, where it should be through their sport, you know, and especially if you're gonna get broke off. And I think if, you know, you're one of the best in the world at what you do, you're going to be a highly competitive person. So you're going to want more weight. You're going to want to go for it. And eventually there's going to be a weight you can't lift. And when you can't lift that weight, things are going to fail and you can break yourself off. Yeah. You can. You might not, but you can. And I've done it, and I've hurt my back. And I did it early when I was lifting with in my bodybuilding kind of days there and lifting way too much weight. And there's more weight. There's always more weight. Yeah, you know, you can always put more weight
unless
on.
Unless you're pairing, you run out of weights.
Unless you run out. But for most mortal humans, you run out or you know, there'll be a weight that you can't push.
Yeah.
I would like to, my perspective is to make a lighter weight heavier. And by maybe changing the form a little bit or, you know, maybe adding more reps or depending on what the goals are, but trying to figure out a way not to wear your body down. Like, and I've gotten to the point where I kind of made it out of sport without wearing my joints down too bad or anything. Like I don't want to go now and start pushing heavy weights. It's just my own perspective. You know, we all get our biased by our own philosophies. And there's a time and place to lift heavy weights for most athletes. I tend to steer away from that, especially if you're not with someone all the time.
Yeah.
But we have like the Agaton there, which is an eccentrically loaded machine where you can push really heavy weights in my eyes, a quite safe way, where the back's protected. And we've just seen a lot of athletes come through with sore low backs. It just seems like a common trend for a lot of high level athletes, the low back gets banged up. And if there's a better way to stress your body without having to possibly stress the low back, then I choose that.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I think the whole thing about strength and conditioning is stressing the body to create an adaptation. And you have to allow that adaptation. It took me a while to figure out that it's not the lifting in the gym that's making me stronger. That's breaking me down. It's when I go home and eat well and recover and sleep and maybe even watch a funny movie. That's when I'm actually getting stronger. And so, yeah, I'm sort of dancing here because it is maybe a tricky topic for most, but for me, it's just my own personal decision. Like, I don't need to be trying to coach an athlete to deadlift or even maybe even power cleans. I don't sometimes want to take the time to coach a power clean because you don't get that much time with an athlete. Even an athlete's career is pretty short. Do we want to waste our time doing that? Like, you need to spend the majority of your time on the bike. I don't want to take time away from you being on the bike by trying to teach power cleans for what, you know,
right.
We can get a med ball and I've hung a bell from the ceiling in the gym and you can throw that med ball for the bell and you're getting the same triple extension you are without raking the bar on your shins and not having to catch it and not what's your form. And it, you know, like just telling you over and over, I'm always embarrassed when I try to coach power cleans and just keep showing up, push your hips through. And yeah, I can remember being taught power cleans myself and they just said, put more weight on, because eventually you can't cheat it with your arms anymore.
Uh-huh.
And then they said, okay, we're not even going to try that with you. You're going to throw this or do that and you get the same explosive movement. So again, I might be short-sighted due to my experience, you know, and that's shaped me in a certain way. And I should have right off the kisser had some sort of disclaimer about like, you know, these are my own opinions and could change by 10 minutes from now.
But that's one thing I really appreciate about you though, is that you're always, you know, taking in the information and synthesizing it. And there's no booklet here. There is no Red Bull booklet that tells you how to work out.
There are, but again, that's just, you know, someone came up with that.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere. Yeah. Why this doesn't need to stay within those confines. I don't believe, and I don't think that's the way of a lot of Red Bull athletes think that way. I think they're kind of people who have approached their sport in a different way and are very unique, special people who deserve that very unique, special attention to try to figure out a different way. I mean, you have action sport athletes or action sport athletes for a reason. They didn't want to be a high school football player. Yeah. You know, they didn't want that. They didn't want to be prom king and queen or whatever. They wanted to go and you know, do what they loved, and a lot of them have found their own way. And not to knock the traditional athletes either. You know,
that's
their way. Everyone, I view it like this, like everyone's trying to get to the top of the mountain. And one group might be hiking from the east and one group might be hiking from the west and they don't see each other. We could say like, okay, you have CrossFit on the east and you have functional, or maybe I don't get it caught up with all the terms. And in some ways I'm very lucky for like basically being in a little box here and don't get exposed to a lot and purposely don't go out and consume a lot of that stuff. But so I can stay true to just what I feels right. But anyways, let's just say there's two different modalities of training that are totally against each other. they're both still trying to make people healthy. They're both still trying to get people to the top of the mountain. So one is not wrong and one is not right. And my goal is to be a kind of a chameleon and be versatile to say, okay, athlete A is hiking from the west, athlete B is hiking from the east. Okay, I've got to now kind of go over to this other side. I've got to meet athlete A where he or she is, and I got to meet athlete B where he or she is. And, and I've got to hike on their path with them. And then at certain times, I might say, geez, you know, we're doubling back. We might take this shortcut and go over here. Or I might say, you know what? I really believe that, you know, once I've established rapport, that we need to hike back.
Yeah.
This is the wrong trail,
yeah.
You know, and we've got to reassess. But if you don't agree with me, I'm sticking with you. We'll go through this. I'm in this with you for what you want to do. It's not, I'm never trying to say, unless it's real, I feel wholeheartedly someone's going to hurt themselves, like, no, you're not doing that. And it's rare. I've hardly ever had to say that, because working with athletes who are best in the world, they know their bodies. They know their bodies better than anybody. You know what you're feeling. And I always try to put that first and say, how are you feeling? What's going on? You know, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
It's usually a great starting point. What have you been doing?
Yeah.
You know, let's start there. You know, and then, okay, that's cool. What do you think about this? Oh, wow. Okay. That's a new way to look at that. Let me go there. You know, I think it's very important that the athlete drives and takes ownership of that training too, instead of, oh, this dude, it's got me on rollerblades again. I'm like, I can't deal with this shit. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love your point about everyone's trying to summit the peak just from a different direction. I can't remember if she put it on social media or we were talking about it in person, but at one point Camille LeBlanc, Bosnier, the CrossFitter,
sure,
was like, everyone's arguing over how to squat in squat form. Isn't it awesome that we're all yelling at each other that we should be squatting? Like, everyone agrees that we should squat.
Yeah.
We're all just, like, you know, doing it our own way. So I thought that was kind of a funny thing that we're, you know, we're splitting all these hairs about the perfect way to do a squat. We all agree that a squat is a great move.
Right.
Very helpful move. So anyway, well, we probably need to wrap up here. You've got dreams to chase
with
athletes, but,
thank you so much.
I wanted to just wrap up. Maybe something comes to mind here. Maybe not. Any standout memories of moments, whether it's, you know, some sort of moment of success for an athlete or something special that happened in the high performance gym, or maybe out on one of our beach workouts or mm-hmm. one of the high performance camps. Like, are there any memories that come to mind? Maybe, you know, it's Collinson doing some crazy thing that you thought, he's done all of these things so far. I wonder, let's just throw something extra crazy at him. And he does it. Like, yeah. Anything that
comes every day, to mind? Every day, man. Yeah. It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But I would say that it's a real honor when an athlete might come back and say, hey, I want to do what you do. I want to train athletes. I want to, you know, that means I've had an impact on someone's life in a pretty crucial way, the same way Victor's had an impact on my life. When athletes kind of say that, or I remember having I thought I didn't really even do anything with this one particular athlete. They had kind of been, what's the word used, graduated and no longer Red Bull athlete. And she was struggling. And so it's like, yeah, I'll send you some workouts. And then I got a call a while back, like, hey, I just want to tell you I'm world champion now. And I thought, huh. And she said, yeah, I'm about to go on the podium right now. And I'm still getting the chills of that. Like, you're calling me before you're going onto the podium? How is, you know,
dude,
that's heavy. I had no idea. I've like, there's some athletes where I've poured myself into 100% and like really trying to have a big impact. And I know I have, where, you know, one of the skateboarders I've spent a lot of time with says, Tyler, I'm no longer a professional skateboarder. I'm a professional athlete. Like, holy shit, that is a cool impact to have. But to have someone that you didn't really think, and I think just at the right time, where people, she probably felt like people had been giving up on her, and it's like, no, I got you here. This is pretty simple. Just do this. And then she was so stoked that it was calling me before she's going on the podium. Like, I thought world championships were 2 weeks ago, you know, it's like,
that's
wow,
incredible. That's really incredible.
I'm honored. And yeah, that's really powerful for me. And that was really powerful for me to say thank you to the people who did that for me. And now to pay that forward, I mean, I couldn't have found a better job for me to have now. You know, I'm very grateful for that. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. makes me want to go get tired in the gym with you.
Let's do it, dude. Let's do it.
Thanks, Tyler.
Payson, thank you so much. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you all for listening. And thank you to SRAM for being presenting partner of this episode. Also, thank you, SRAM, for being presenting partner of my sweet little evening adventure ride the other night. I'm just kidding. I didn't have a presenting partner for that ride, but I felt like I did because I was riding a trail that I'd never seen and the sun had just set. It was dark. Well, in these Marin Headland hills, oftentimes when you're riding amongst the redwoods, it's dark when it's an absolute bluebird day at noon. The trees are thick and it's very shaded in there, but add in some dusk and it was hard to see. And yet I was still having so much fun just tiptoeing at speed through these pretty challenging, rooty trails that I'd never seen. And it occurred to me as I was doing this, how thankful I was to have my RockShox Axis dropper, because it was not that long ago that I would be doing that sort of ride high-posted. And it's just such a completely different experience. It's just, you can't even really compare the two. If you're a fan of mountain biking, I just so recommend getting a dropper post. It is an absolute game changer. I assume most of y'all have them, but if not, do yourself a favor and get one. You think mountain biking is fun now, just try after. Absolutely, my go-to choice is the RockShox Axis. It's completely insane to have dropper technology like that that works so well and is 100% wireless. Like, where are the technology that we have access to these days for mountain biking is just so fun. What a wonderful time to be alive as a cyclist. Thank you, Lily McKelvin, for editing and producing this show each and every week. Thank y'all for spreading the word. If you'd like to go further than subscribing to the show, leaving a comment, leaving a rating, and telling your friends about the show, you can go to patreon.com/theadventurestash and become a sustaining member. And what happens there is you can sign up, and every week you will automatically be making a donation to the show. So you can decide what the value is. If you feel this show is worth $1 a month to you, just go there and sign up. Maybe you decide that this show is worth $25 an episode to you and you want to donate $100 a month. If that's the case, you can go do that too. But if you decide that somewhere in between feels right, maybe $250 a show, that's $10 a month. And as a thank you, we will send you our OG logo t-shirt. It's the only way to get one. And some stickers, of course. Thank you all for listening. Catch you next week.